From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this week. A lot to get to today. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, and Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman. And we are starting our conversation out with Ian today. Ian, happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Okay, so Ian, I want to start with the open primary initiative because this just continues to get more and more buzz. But before we get into what's going on with it right now, the open primary initiative is set to be on the November ballot. It got enough signatures. The Secretary of State's office certified it. It is supposed to be on the ballot. Can you explain to folks who maybe have not been keeping up on this, what exactly is this open primary initiative?
Yes. So this is a initiative related to elections and how they work in the state. And it's essentially has two parts. The first part would end Idaho's closed primary system. So for a little over a decade, parties in the state have been able to close their primaries just to registered voters. So the Republican Party in Idaho has done this for a while now, where you have to be a registered Republican to vote in their primary. And the primary election is held in the spring before the general election in the fall, which everyone votes in. But the primary election in the spring is when, of course, parties kind of pick the nominees for whatever election the person who's going to run under that party name is selected at the primary election. So it's an important election, especially in a state like Idaho, where the state tends to lean heavily Republican in a lot of areas. And so often the GOP primary in May is determining who's going to likely win in November. So what this initiative would change about how the primary works is it would replace the closed primary system with an open primary. So any voter in the state who's eligible to vote would be able to vote in that primary, and the top four candidates, regardless of whatever party they're in, would proceed to the November election, and they'd be on the ballot in November. And then the second part of the open primary initiative is changing how that general election, essentially how the votes are tallied in that election. So rather than kind of the standard way where you pick your candidate and the votes are all counted, and the candidate with the most votes in that initial round wins, it would replace that with a system called ranked choice voting, or sometimes called instant runoff elections, where it would give voters the option of, in addition to picking their preferred candidate, they could also rank after that their second, third, or fourth choice candidate. And then in the initial round of voting, candidates that have very low numbers of votes ascribed to them would be essentially removed, and those people who voted for those candidates, their second choice ranking would instead go towards that candidate, and then it would kind of proceed in a couple of rounds like that until you had a candidate with a majority. So that's how the ranked choice portion would work, and that's what's at the moment scheduled to be on the ballot in November.
Okay, so as we said, it is set to be on the ballot in November. The Secretary of State, you know, verified signatures, so that is why it can be on the ballot. With that said, Ian, the Attorney General, Raul Labrador, he, and to no surprise, sued to keep the initiative off the ballot. What was his reasoning for this?
Yeah, so Attorney General Labrador has sued over this, and I should note here, he's been kind of a longtime opponent of this voter initiative ever since kind of it got up steam late last year. And he has sued since the initiative was allowed to be on the ballot this month. It was determined by the Secretary of State's office that it qualified, as you mentioned. And he's sued essentially on two grounds. First, he says that the initiative violates the requirement for initiatives and state in new state laws that they cover essentially one subject. He says that what I just described is kind of the two parts of this, the change to how primary elections work and the change to how general elections work, that those are separate items and should be handled on, you know, they're they're not directly related to each other, and so they're separate subjects, and so it violates that requirement for a ballot initiative. The second piece of what he objects to is he's making a claim that at least some of the advertising and kind of advocacy for this ballot initiative has been deceptive to voters. Labrador is alleging that the group was kind of emphasizing the Open Primaries Act aspect. It's called the Open Primaries Initiative, and was not emphasizing the ranked choice voting aspect of this, which is the change to the November election where people would have the option of ranking their choices. Of course, I should say that the Open Primaries Initiative organization, you know, they've called this lawsuit a political stunt. They say that their volunteers who collected tens of thousands of signatures were careful to kind of explain the full extent of what it would do and how it would affect elections in the state. And they think that the initiative doesn't violate that single subject requirement because both of the issues are about elections. Both of the changes relate to state elections. And so that's the same subject. But those are the grounds that Labrador has filed suit under.
Okay. So there's another part to this now. And that is there is now a possible conflict of interest between the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State's office. And this has to do with what attorneys represent what entities. So break this down for us now.
Yeah, I'll do my best. So it gets a bit complicated, but essentially the Attorney General is one way of thinking of the Attorney General is this, the state's lawyer. He's responsible for representing state agencies and different branches of the state government in litigation. And in this case, even though Labrador is not specifically alleging that Secretary of State Phil McGrain did anything wrong related to this Open Primaries Initiative, he's still technically suing the Secretary of State because he's asking the court to prevent the ballot initiative from going before voters. And the Secretary of State, as the official responsible for organizing and carrying out the state's elections, is kind of he's the officer who the court could order in theory to stop the ballot initiative. He's the one who's going to be sending the directions to print those ballots, et cetera. So while on the one hand, Labrador is suing the Secretary of State, his office, different attorneys in his office are at the same time representing the Secretary of State because the Attorney General's office has lawyers who are essentially assigned to different branches of the government to represent them. So there are attorneys in his office who they work for Labrador, but they are representing the Secretary of State in this case. And so that kind of raises a question of, even though Labrador is saying that they are different attorneys within his office and that he's implemented what he called ethical screening measures to essentially separate those different attorneys within his office, they still ultimately report to him. And so that's, I think, raised some questions about the standard rules that apply in litigation and in lawsuits, both in government and in private practice, which are based on the rules of professional conduct, which are essentially standards that lawyers must adhere to. And they generally kind of say that you can't have a conflict. You can't represent someone who is both a plaintiff and a respondent in a lawsuit. You know, if you're representing a landlord in court who's suing a tenant, you probably can't represent the landlord and the tenant at the same time. The same lawyer can't, that is.
Well, like the same lawyer can't represent, like the same lawyer cannot represent two people in a divorce.
Exactly. That's another good example. And so the question here is, you know, obviously this is because it's a government situation, it's a little bit more complicated than an example like that. But the Supreme Court has raised this question in this lawsuit. Earlier this week, they asked Labrador to essentially provide justification for why he doesn't have a conflict of interest and why his office is able to represent the Secretary of State. And so we're waiting on a response from the court rather, we're sorry, we're waiting on an order from the court on that. We might get it perhaps today or sometime next week. And I should just note here, this is really an accelerated lawsuit. The lawsuit was just filed only a matter of a few days ago. And now the Secretary of State and the AG are kind of debating what the timeline would need to be to resolve this. So initially, Labrador had said this needed to be resolved by early September, because that's when the Secretary of State is required to send the ballot initiative, if it's going to be on the ballot, to the county clerk so that they can prepare for the November election. But McGrane, the Secretary of State, is saying that that's actually much too late, and he needs the this resolved by early August. So essentially next week, in order to print a voter pamphlet that's going to be sent out to voters before that. So we're waiting for a court now to see on a court order now to see what they think of the potential conflict of interest here.
All right. Well, I tell you, this just gets more and more complicated the closer we get to Election Day. Before I let you go, Ian, I want to talk a little bit about this recent library bill that became law July 1. Quickly explain to us what this new law does.
Yeah, so this law got a lot of attention this past session, and it's a topic that's been in discussion at the legislature for a few years now. And what it would do, it was House Bill 710 that ultimately passed, in which Governor Brad Little signed, and it would allow library patrons to sue a library if they believe that there's material, books or other media in the library that are inappropriate for minors, that have sexually explicit materials that are, you know, offensive and that are not appropriate for minors. And so someone could initially, the person has to file a complaint about a particular book and give the library time 60 days to respond to that. But then after that, if the material has not been moved to an adults only section, they could, that person could file a lawsuit.
Okay. So there's been another lawsuit filed in regards to this new law. And that is, Ian, and this is coming from private schools and privately funded libraries here in Idaho, because we have an interesting caveat in this new law that other states that have implemented similar laws do not have.
Right. So there's a coalition of private schools and some privately funded libraries in the state, as well as a couple of parents who are suing this law, arguing that it's unconstitutional and unfairly invasive on the rights of parents and these institutions to provide books that they believe their children want to read or which are educational to those kids. And so the coalition is arguing that Idaho's law is the first in the nation to affect not only public schools, but to reach into private institutions like private schools and even church libraries, and would apply to them as well. And so they're arguing that this is an infringement on the rights of those institutions. Mm-hmm. And they're also arguing that the law that the state passed is the kind of definition of what's harmful to children is based on the state's obscenity laws. And it's there's language in that that focuses on homosexuality, kind of calls out homosexuality in a way that it doesn't necessarily other types of sexuality. And so I think one of the things that, and this was discussed, you know, at the time that the law was passed, but one of the things that they discuss in the lawsuit is that there's concern that this might, in theory, apply not just to, you know, sexual activity, but just like gay life, just kind of displays of, you know, gay marriage or a gay partnership, that could, in theory, someone could interpret that as obscene under the definitions from the state of what is obscene that date from the 1970s. And that's one of the other things that they object to.
Okay. And this is just in the beginning phases. So at this point, we're just kind of waiting to see where this lawsuit goes.
Yes. And I should note it, the law is in effect now. It went into effect in July, and already we're seeing some impacts. The small library in Donnelly, they said that they are going to be switching to an adults-only library, essentially, because of concerns that about what lawsuits might come if they kind of keep their library as it was now that this law is in place.
So, Kevin, school choice was a big issue during this last legislative session, and there were lots of opinions about this on both sides of the aisle. And now there seems to be a bit of a twist because Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield made a bit of an announcement earlier this week.
Yeah, this is pretty significant, Gemma. Superintendent Critchfield, at a meeting of school administrators from all over the state, their annual conference in Boise this week, she said that she has been engaged in active conversations with the governor's office about some kind of a school choice bill. She didn't go in any kind of detail about what that bill would entail, what that bill would look like. She said the details aren't fully baked yet, but the fact that she is working on something and that she's talking to the governor about something is a fairly significant development in this debate, because Superintendent Critchfield has been pretty lukewarm to downright skeptical about the idea of going down this road of providing private school choice. Back when she was first elected, I went back, I looked at the quote, I used the quote again in my story on Thursday. She said, right in January of 2023, right after she was sworn in, that she was not prepared to advocate for the idea of putting public money into private schools. Now, that was, 18, 19 months ago. So right now, she's at least opening the door to talking about something, because we know there are going to be a lot of school choice bills likely to surface during the next legislative session.
Oh, well, right. I mean, Kevin, this, I would say this issue is not going to go away.
And I think that's part of why Critchfield is getting out on the issue right now. She basically said, without calling out the sponsors of it, she basically said that the folks who pushed a tax credit bill last session, this was a bill that died in the House, she felt that a lot of school leaders felt like they didn't have a place at the table in the discussion about that legislation. So she said to the administrators, I want to make sure that we're at the table. I want to set our own table and begin this conversation. Not surprisingly, though, the administrators didn't seem to be terribly enthusiastic about what they heard. There wasn't people throwing chairs or anything, but there wasn't a whole lot of support for the idea of the superintendent coming out in favor of this.
Well, I think it's something we're going to, of course, continue watching, in particular as we head into the legislative session in January. Yeah, absolutely. So, Carly, let's talk charter schools for a moment, because historically, charter schools and school districts haven't liked each other much. Can you tell us maybe why that is?
Yeah. So like you said, traditionally charter and traditional schools have competed over educational approaches and outcomes, enrollment, and public dollars. And part of their contention is because, as one superintendent told me, charters are sometimes created in spite of a district when patrons are fed up with the local school. So there's not always a spirit of camaraderie from the start per se. The other factor is that whenever a new charter starts up, it pulls students from the local district, and those students are tied to state dollars, so it makes a financial impact. And sometimes teachers switch from the district to a charter, so it can exacerbate staffing issues as well. And when the Idaho charter movement started in 1998, it was meant to complement and support innovation in traditional districts, but it hasn't always worked out that way because of that underlying tension and competition.
So this rivalry, though, seems to be shifting a bit, Carly, right? Because there are three new charter schools opening in the next couple of weeks, because school starts soon. And what, they're going into a partnership with some school districts?
Yeah. And so I've used the term partnership because it's just simpler and easier to understand. But basically, it's the local district sponsoring or authorizing the charter instead of the charter commission. So that means the district is responsible for overseeing the charter and making sure its academics, operations, and finances are all meeting goals. So districts kind of take the charter in as one of their own, touting it to parents and students as an option, just like they would with one of their own schools. And in theory, both entities benefit from sharing the cost of overhead or certain staff, like school resource officers. And then if the lines of communication are open, the schools could learn from what's working from each other. And I think it's an important conversation because as the private school choice debate continues to swirl in Idaho, like Kevin was just talking about, these partnerships show two very different kinds of public schools kind of putting aside self-interest and working together to put students first and ensure they do have choices. So a couple of the new partnerships are in West Ada and Bonneville, which is near Idaho Falls. And in both cases, these districts said that they decided to partner with these charters because they offered something new to the district that the district didn't already have. So the West Ada charter is called Pathways in Education. It offers hybrid learning for students in grades 9 through 12 and up to age 21. And then Elevate with Bonneville, they serve at-risk students from grades 6 through 12. And Bonneville's alternative school right now primarily is for juniors and seniors. So partnerships don't always make sense if a charter repeats services and approaches a district already offers. But in some cases, it's worth it and still happening, even amid a long history of contention between the two types of public schools.
Well, I think it's interesting, Carly, because as you said, right, it's maybe finding that collaboration where your traditional public school doesn't offer certain things, like you said, hybrid learning, right? But that might really work and be really successful for some students.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why these districts are saying, you know, we're losing or we're willing to lose enrollment and lose public dollars because ultimately what matters is these students in our community, no matter what school they go to, they're all our students. And with the Bonneville School District, the superintendent there wanted to see that kids were getting earlier interventions if they were struggling and getting on track to graduate, even if that meant certain losses for his district.
So Kevin, this next story, I have to admit, I kind of put on the back burner, and even though it's been going on for a while, that's the lawsuit between Big City Coffee and Boise State University. So first, give us a refresher on this.
Yeah, Gemma, I couldn't help myself. I called this a long percolating dispute in print this week.
I noticed that.
But it's accurate. This has been going on now for almost 4 years. I mean, this goes back to 2020 when Big City Coffee opened a coffee shop on the Boise State campus. They weren't there very long. As we know, Sarah Findley, who is the owner of Big City Coffee, is a very outspoken supporter of law enforcement, of police, the thin blue line, all of those themes. And that didn't sit well with a number of students who pushed back about having Big City Coffee on campus. So by the fall of 2020, Big City was off campus. Now, the crux of the dispute is, was Big City forced off of campus because of their owner's politics, or did they voluntarily leave, as Boise State contends? Lawsuit was filed in 2021, $10 million lawsuit against Boise State. It is still going on, and there were a bunch of orders that came down from the district judge last week. The big one, I thought, was that the judge ordered the two sides to go into mediation sometime before August 23rd, and the timing of that I found significant because this is still scheduled to go to a jury trial on August 28th. So mediation might be possibly a last-ditch attempt to try to settle this thing out of court before a jury trial. But right now, it's still scheduled to go to trial. Other developments out of the rulings last week, the judge again said that Marlene Tromp, president of Boise State University, is not a defendant in this lawsuit, should not be listed, will not be listed as a defendant in the lawsuit. A couple of other, one current Boise State administrator, one former Boise State administrator, they are still listed as defendants. Just a lot of stuff. There were a lot of rulings that came down last week, just a flurry of them. And I did a rundown of everything that the judge ruled on in a story that I ran earlier this week.
Yeah, because there is really a lot there. So folks, if you want
to... There's a lot to get to. And there's just, you can tell just from what's being argued over in court, there's a lot of animosity between the two sides that has not dissipated over the past 4 years. So, you know, the order of mediation, we'll see where it goes. But at this point, you know, things definitely sound like it may be heading towards a jury trial the end of this month.
Wow. Okay. Well, we will definitely keep our eyes on that. But folks, if you do want to really get in depth with this, make sure you read Kevin's article at Idaho Ed News, because it really goes in depth. So Carly, let's talk about the Boise School District right now, because they have a fairly controversial grading policy, to put it lightly. Can you update folks on how this policy works? Because if I'm reading this right, teachers basically can't give students a zero.
Yeah, that's right. So the Boise School District eliminated zeros and added a grading floor in 2017. Since then, students have been guaranteed at least a 50% on all assignments, essays, quizzes, and projects, even if they don't do them and even if their score is lower. So the reason behind that is because the Boise School District wanted to revamp the grading system. They wanted to foster an intrinsic motivation to learn among students and make grading simpler and more accurate. As an administrator explained it to me, they wanted students to think of doing assignments as building a body of evidence to show what you know, instead of this idea of just like completing tasks, this rote task completion. So the new grading scale that they had in mind would switch from a 0 to 100 scale to a 4 or 5 point scale based on rubrics. And part of that's because, you know, say you're a teacher grading an essay, how do you explain the difference between like a 93 and a 98? You have 100 choices or 101 if you think about the zero, and that can lead to inconsistent grading practices. Like maybe one teacher gives it an A, another a C. So in theory, with the smaller grading choices, like a 4 or 5 choices, the grading's more consistent and accurate. And then the way that the scores are explained, it gets the students thinking more about where they are in their learning journey instead of harvesting points. But it was too big of a change to make all at once. The district needed to communicate about the changes with staff, students, parents, stakeholders, and their grading software would need to be overhauled. So the 50% grading floor was meant to be a temporary fix, but then the pandemic happened, which slowed things down considerably. So Boise is still using what was meant to be a temporary solution.
Okay, so with that said, Carly, I don't mean to be a pessimist here, but I do have a high schooler and a middle schooler living in my home. And them being motivated by, you know, learning is just kind of laughable. They know they have to go to school. They know that our expectation is they need to do well. And that's just the rule in our house. And I would think that there are teachers who may be frustrated by this, in the sense that, and frankly, as a parent, I would be upset if my child couldn't get a zero if they did not do an assignment.
Yeah, and that is exactly what's happening when the theory is put into reality. And teachers in at least 3 Boise high schools began meeting informally last school year to air their frustrations and brainstorm solutions. A lot of these teachers didn't want to speak on the record, but I did talk to one who was willing to give her name. That was Annie Muniz. She's a science teacher at Timberline. And she said students can basically choose to do or not do an assignment, and there's not really a high penalty for it. So some students are doing a quarter of work and nothing for the second quarter, and they're still passing. Even among highly motivated students, she says they become masters at manipulating the system. They can pack their schedules with advanced courses to make their transcripts glow and their GPA soar, and they're able to pull it off because they don't have to do all the work in each class. On top of that, their learning becomes fragmented because they're picking and choosing what they want to do. So yeah, there's been quite a bit of pushback. So I talked to district officials about that. I also talked to the educational consultant who brought this idea to Boise, and his name's Tom Schimmer. And he said the grading floor is an imperfect solution to an already imperfect system. He said, education has gone through such an evolution. Why would grading be the one thing that is untouchable? So amid all these complaints, Boise leaders are doubling down. They remain committed. They say sea change takes time, and fully getting there is still years away. In the meantime, they did create a committee to look at the grading policy, see what they can do to alleviate issues in the meantime. So they're looking into how to adapt their grading software, educating stakeholders, and then they're kind of implementing some new policies at the schools as well to speed this up and see how it goes before bringing it to the rest of the district. And one of their administrators told me it's a long road, but ultimately the goal is to make students think about growth instead of a grade.
Yeah. Okay. With that said, though, this policy has been in place for 7 years now. So when administrators say, "Oh, it's a, you know, it can't just happen overnight. You know, it takes time." It's like, well, it's been 7 years, and in that time, in 7 years, you've graduated many students who, as you mentioned, Annie Muniz, the science teacher at Timberline, in your article, she says she's concerned that these kids will not be college ready, and how can they be? If even the, as you said, the very advanced students know how to work the system. So, I mean, did the district give you any idea as to when they might implement more of this new structure so students are held more accountable so that they can be ready to adult?
I didn't get like an exact specific date, but it sounded to me like it would take 2 to 3 more years. And part of why it takes so long is they usually will pilot something at one school for a year, see how it goes, bring it to the rest of the district. But yeah, your concerns about impacts on college readiness were also echoed by teachers. And in terms of academic achievements, I did look at the scores from 2017 to 23. I saw that ISAT math and SAT scores were down, but ELA proficiency rates were up, and graduation rates are now about the same as they were in 2017. So
Okay. All right.
we'll
Well,
see
we will
what
keep an eye on
happens.
this. Yeah, I find it fascinating, actually, as a journalist and as a parent, definitely. Kevin, University of Idaho, still trying to acquire the University of Phoenix. I've got about 3 minutes left with you. Let's dig into the cost of this. Holy cow.
Yeah, Gemma, I wanted to follow up on some stories we did earlier this year to see exactly how much the U of I has spent on due diligence, on consulting, on legal counsel pertaining to the proposed purchase. And the figure that we got a couple of weeks ago, it's through June, $14.2 million is the best that I can calculate that the U of I has shelled out, has laid out in consulting, due diligence. A couple of things that jumped out at me, aside from that figure itself, which is pretty noteworthy. The biggest chunk of money goes to Hogan Lovells, an international law firm. That's where U of I President Scott Green worked until 2019 when he returned to U of I as president. That firm has received $9.2 million of work. U of I defends that and says it really, you know, they are the most qualified firm out there, regardless of you know, Green's relationship, prior relationship with the firm. They said that this firm is expert in federal education law, acquisitions process, and other issues central to the Phoenix purchase. Another thing jumped out at me: over $500,000 this year to Holly Troxell. That's a law firm in Boise that has been kind of the U of I's go-to on constitutional questions, and there have been a lot of constitutional questions about the acquisition. That was really the heart of some of the legislative debate we saw this session about the purchase. So the money just keeps getting spent. Important to note, though, that at this point, U of I has already received $5 million from the University of Phoenix to offset some of their upfront costs. U of I could receive up to $20 million from Phoenix, even if Phoenix doesn't wind up affiliating with U of I. They have said that. And they have agreed to pay up to $20 million if Phoenix goes to another partner, sells to somebody else, or if they go it alone, go public, start an IPO. So it's possible that all of these costs will be offset and will be covered by Phoenix. We'll obviously keep an eye on that in the months to come. But it just gives you a sense of just how much money has been laid out by the U of I. You know, how much they've had to take out of reserves, how much they've taken out of surplus to cover this potential purchase. It's, you know, again, we just wanted to follow up the numbers and see where we stand right now.
Jay Tusk, the KTVB's news director, not news director, sports director. I just upgraded you, Jay, is joining us to talk all things Olympics, in particular about the athletes from Idaho who are competing over in Paris right now. Jay, really great to have you on the show.
Oh, I am so excited to talk about the Olympics. Any chance that I get to hype up Team Idaho, I will obviously jump at that opportunity. Good to be on with you today, Gemma.
Well, I have to tell you, I love the Olympics, so I am so excited. And I understand that there are 10 athletes, one alternate from Idaho, competing in the Olympics. So, Jay, what sports are these athletes competing in?
Yeah, a variety of sports. So we have track and field athletes. We have boxers. We have, an Olympian that is playing volleyball right now. So of the athletes that represent Team Idaho, 11, including the alternate, but 10 definitely that are all going to compete. Eight of them will compete for Team USA, with three of them serving as alternates. Two of them will run for Great Britain. And then we have a College of Southern Idaho alumna that is playing volleyball for Team Japan.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool. Okay, so I realize too, we've got a lot of cycling ties here in Idaho to the Olympics. Okay, can we start with Chloe Dygert? She is pretty incredible.
Oh, she is. And she went through, some crazy adversity really over her few years. I mean, we're talking 4 years ago. She had a leg injury that she didn't know if her cycling career was going to be completely over. And she comes back to the Olympics and she's making this tremendous push to get on the podium. And the course conditions in Paris were just awful. It rained all throughout the day on the time trial day. And she slips and her bike gives out from under her and she crashes. And she gets up on the bike, gets back up on that bike, if you will, a perfect metaphor. And she still is able to win a bronze medal. And so she's extremely competitive. I know that she wanted gold. She is still young enough that she will make a push for gold in 2028.
Well, and I have to say, Jay, I saw that when she fell, and I have friends who are cyclists. I am not, but they talked about just how incredible it was that not only did she like get right back up on her bike, but that she medaled. I mean, that speaks volumes just about, I think that just her as an athlete, but also the spirit of the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that athletes train every 4 years for. And this is what I love about the Olympics, Gemma, is it is your one opportunity. Every 4 years, you have one opportunity to be at your absolute best, and you train for 4 years for that exact moment. And for Chloe, it didn't go as scripted, and she still finds a way, though, to accomplish at least part of her goal, which was bringing an Olympic gold medal back to the United States of America, and Olympic medal, that is. And the cool thing about it, too, is she was actually the first bronze medal for Team USA at the 2024 Games. So she's got her little spot in the Paris Olympics U.S. history, if you will, for sure.
Well, hey, and she brought home a medal. Okay, so there are some other cyclists that we should be paying attention to as well.
Yes.
Well, we have Mateo Jorgensen.
Yes.
Let's talk about him.
Yeah, Mateo is a graduate of Boise High. Mateo just got done with a 3+ week race, the Tour de France, overseas. And so, there's about, I think, 10 days between when the tour concluded and when he will actually race in the Paris Games. And now his ride in Paris is much shorter. It's only like 100 miles or so.
Oh yeah. Only,
it's insane to see or to think that it's even possible for Mateo, a 25-year-old from Boise, to go through the Tour de France, where he placed eighth, by the way, easily his best career finish. He had back-to-back-to-back top 10 finishes at the end of the Tour de France, and now he rides off to Paris, where he has a great shot at podium in there as well. Like, Gemma, he's young, he's talented. I just can't wait to see how much endurance he has left in him, though, after the Tour de France.
And then there's, Haley Batten? Did I say her last name
yes.
right?
Yes, she does mountain bike. And I don't know if you had the chance to watch this event, Gemma. I would suggest anybody watch the event. It's actually awesome. I mean, it's, your typical cycling race type of racing, but you're doing it over rocks and through mud and dirt. And it is so much fun to watch. And there's the element of the course, the terrain is so tough, you could blow out a tire. I mean, there are a ton of unknowns and uncontrollables that can happen to a rider in that race. That being said, Haley had a flat tire in the race, and I'm watching, and all of a sudden she just drops off. I mean, she was like in the top four the whole way, and about midway through the race again, she just kind of falls off the lead pack, and then we're like, where did she go? What happened? Well, she blew out a tire, and still she gets back up on the bike and just was just ferocious over the final last half of that race, and climbs all the way up to second place, finishes with the silver medal. That is the best finish by an American, male or female, in the mountain bike by Team USA at the Olympics ever. So Haley Batten, you could argue she's the best in U.S. history on the mountain bike.
Okay, I love that. And I agree with you. People go watch that race because you literally see her carrying her bike at one point with the flat tire. It's crazy. Okay, we have a boxer, and she just competed, right? Like, I mean, literally right before we got on the air. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Alyssa Mendoza, she is so cool. She's only 20 years old. Born in Caldwell, Idaho, went to Middleton High School. She is so gosh darn resilient for how young she is. And she basically had, we'll call it, three opportunities to qualify for the Olympics. And they were spread out about over 6 months. And in the first two qualifiers, she basically made it all the way to the final bout before she was eliminated. And she's just had these crazy heartbreaking moments where she almost gave up boxing. I mean, crazy to think, a few months ago, she almost said, you know what, I just don't know if I want to do this anymore. She pushes through with the love and care of her father, JR, her mom, Wendy, tremendous people. Her dad was born in Mexico. They boxed their whole life. JR's father basically put boxing gloves on his six sons and said, go have fun. And he moved to America when he was a teenager, passed on his love for boxing to his children. He has a number of kids that box. They have their own gym out in Middleton where they train. And anyways, in May, she went to Bangkok and made it all the way to the final bout once again. We were all holding our breath, and she got over that final hump this time, qualifying for the Olympics. So she gets to Paris. She wins her opening round match in the round of 32. Today, she took on a boxer 8 years older than her, a two-time Olympian from Brazil. Experience just seemed to favor the boxer from Brazil today, who wanted a decision 4-1 over Alyssa. But Alyssa will be back. Mark my words, can't wait for the LA Games in 28.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Jay, I only have about a minute or so left with you. I want to quickly talk track and field because that starts tonight. Any Idaho athletes that we need to keep our eye on?
Yes, I'm specifically going to focus on the ones that live in Idaho. Shari Hawkins in the heptathlon was born in Rexburg. Another tremendous story. She qualified for the Olympics in Eugene at the last second. And then Marissa Howard. She is the magical mama, if you will, because she had her son Kai 2 years ago. In her first U.S. Olympic trials after having her boy, she qualifies for her first Olympics. She runs in the 3,000-meter steeplechase on Sunday. Get up early, Jem. It's at 2 a.m. or stay up late, either or. I will be watching her.
Oh, my gosh. Jay, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. I know you're going to be back next Friday as well, so we can run through all things Olympics. Just thank you. I love the Olympics so much. It has been great talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. We'll start looking at the 2028 games a little bit too, since the Olympics will be almost over next Friday.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.